Hello, and welcome to Still Scared, Talking Children's Horror, a podcast about creepy, spooky and disturbing children's books, films and TV. I'm Adam Wybray, and my co-host is usually Ren Wednesday, but today is a special bonus episode in which I'm talking to Doctors Lauren Stevenson and Robert Edgar about their co-edited essay collection, Horrifying Children, Hauntology, and the Legacy of Children's Television. A full transcript is available at the link, so click that for show notes and more. And I hope you enjoy this discussion about an essay collection I contributed to, but am in no way being reimbursed for, until I get my special edition of the book in the post. Enjoy! This is Adam here for Still Scared, Talking Children's Horror, and this is a special bonus episode talking about an exciting new collection, Horrifying Children, Hauntology and the Legacy of Children's Television, which intersects with a lot of my interests, and Ren's too, although Ren is having a very busy week of it, and so deferred responsibilities over to me. So apologies that you won't be hearing Ren's chipper and occasionally dulcet tones. But I am joined here by two of the co-editors of the book alongside John Marland, Lauren Stevenson and Hello. Robert Edgar. Hello, Lauren and Robert.
Hello.
So we've previously had the brilliant Catherine Lester on the show, writer of Horror Films for Children, which was published a few years back. Also by Bloomsbury, and looking at the blurb for your book, which reads, Horrifying Children examines weird and eerie children's television and literature via critical analysis, memoir and autoethnography, it notes that there has been an explosion of interest in the impact of children's television and literature of the late 20th century, in particular the 70s, 80s and 90s. So that obviously covers quite a lot of the kind of thing we talk about on this podcast. And I was wondering what you felt was behind this kind of explosion of interest and whether that explosion of interest is something you've noticed before you came to the project or not.
I can kick off with that one, if that's okay, Lauren.
Yeah, of course.
I do think there's something very interesting that's happened in recent years, and I think there's probably a number of different reasons why 70s, 80s and 90s have kind of come into view for people and us in particular. When it was something we were well aware of prior to putting the collection together, and it was really some of the initial focus of the collection was around in the original conception. It was a lot of it was focused around 70s, early 80s, and then we moved into looking at 90s and realised I think that it was a much bigger time period than perhaps we'd first thought of. But I think there's a few things. I think partly it's perhaps people of a certain age looking back to childhood. I think that's part of it, and I think it's interesting. Something we talk about in the introduction to the book is about people that kind of going in cycles, and you can see that throughout children's television, that people of a particular age group then kind of reflect on childhood, and often a childhood which is just out of memory or is kind of buried deep in memory, so it's very much from early childhood, so that kind of fuzziness of memory I think is really important. I think it's also significant that we're talking about pre-digital age, largely, where things aren't perhaps as easily accessed, and again, things drift into distant memory a little bit. We're having to dredge things up from memory rather than being able to easily access everything. And I think also, and something we touch on in the book, is that there's been some real revelations about things that happened in the 70s and 80s, and the period that perhaps once felt that people were perhaps nostalgic for, suddenly we think of it as actually genuinely dark and dangerous and unpleasant and unsettling. And it causes us, it's caused us, and it's causing us to revise our view of that period. So I think there's some of the reasons there.
Yeah, that all makes perfect sense to me. Lauren, did you have any additional thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that you can look to the kind of the rise in popularity of analog horror here as well as maybe an indicator of what's going on. I think while a lot of these texts are kind of pre-digital, they've kind of taken on a new resonance in digital spaces. People kind of finding clips or memorabilia from these eras, and they've become kind of creepypasta online, you know, circulated around, for people to kind of either unlock their own memories of those texts, you know, these things that are kind of buried and we've forgotten about for 20 years, and then all of a sudden you're confronted with, you know, somebody's YouTube short that uses that material, or you know, something that you've maybe not come across, and you think, you know, what is this out of context? And I do think that that indicates this kind of growing fascination with a particular kind of analog style of hauntological material or kind of cursed material, maybe, if we wanted to go that far.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
I don't think it's just an interest for Generation X's and millennials that it certainly the Discord I use for horror games by a really brilliant horror creator called Yames. Like, it's mostly people a bit younger than me, mostly Zoomers on there, and they love analog horror. In fact, there's largely them who brought analog horror to my attention, and a lot of the kind of games I've seen Zoomers really enjoy, some of which have been made by millennials, are things like Baldi's Basics, which really tap into kind of edutainment aesthetic that was very much part of my childhood playing CD-ROM games as a kid. So I certainly, I think there's a kind of interest, interestingly, that's broader than just a kind of the obvious nostalgia. So, in terms of your own research histories, like how do they link into the unsettling side of children's media?
I mean, I'm just a huge horror nerd, to be totally honest with you. So a lot of what I've done previously research-wise has focused in on kind of how horror intersects with kind of social and political contexts, and I think that that comes through quite strongly in the collection, this idea that there's something about conceptions of childhood, conceptions of safety contemporarily that are then coming through in these bits of material. But I also think we're both just very keen on the kind of the dark side of this stuff. I don't know about you, Rob, and kind of exploring what fascinates us about all of this and why, of all the things that could kind of stick with us over the years, this is the sort of stuff that we keep revisiting, you know.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Robert?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And with Lauren on that one, it is that real fascination with the dark material. And you know, like Lauren, a huge horror fan, but not as expert in horror as Lauren is. I'd come at it kind of slightly from sort of an uncanny fiction angle. And myself and John, who couldn't be with us tonight, and another colleague, Alan Smith, had written a book about Thomas Hardy and folk horror. And also another colleague of ours, Wayne Johnson, myself, were working on the Routledge Companion to Folk Horror, which Lauren has a chapter in as well, a superb chapter on similar things. So we were sort of really immersed, a group of us at the university, really immersed in this kind of research. And it was fascinating. And the Horrifying Children book was being developed alongside that, but it was really interesting to see the amount of interest there was in the companion to folk horror around children's fiction, children's television, And similar things, the resonance of the past, of analog horror, it was a very, very real, a much bigger presence in that book than we thought it would be. So there's lots of it around.
I mean, that makes sense to me. We've just recorded an episode on The Weird Stone of Persingamon, the Alan Garner novel. And obviously, The Owl Service is a kind of key example of both children's horror and folk horror that crops up again and again, certainly for people of a certain age. In terms of your own, so you're Robert, did you watch The Owl Service when you were younger, Robert?
It's just it was well. It's an interesting one that because I didn't watch it at the time. I'm not quite old enough to have seen it, but I do remember it being around, and being mentioned. But I remember Alan Garner. We a few of us do have a book out under review at the moment about Alan Garner. So there's again more of this stuff around. But I remember Alan Garner from school libraries. These rather dusty books tucked away in the corner of school libraries. So it was a presence on television, but Garner in this work was evident elsewhere, which is interesting in itself. So yeah, I watched The Owl Service for the first time actually not that long ago, but I knew all about it from other sources.
So, what kind of things sort of scared you when you were a child? I mean, I was a very scaredy child, as was Ren. So, we've talked at length over the last sort of 6 or 7 years about all sorts of things that scared us. But what about you?
Oh, that's a tough one because I think I was desensitized quite early on, if I'm being totally honest. I got my hands on all sorts of stuff I shouldn't have been watching as a child.
Okay.
So quite early on, I was kind of a bit hardened to some of it. But there were moments, I can remember certain moments, mostly from really odd places. So not necessarily from, children's horror specifically, but I can remember, for example, watching The Bodyguard for the first time. And there's a moment where Whitney Houston, sorry, picks the phone up because she thinks she's talking to her son and it's a stalker. And he just repeats the word no down the phone in a really elongated voice a couple of times. And then you sort of see the close up, the horror on her face that she's not talking to the person that she thought she was talking to. And for some reason, that always just really bothered me. And it's those moments that I think come out of something that's not necessarily intended to be horror that perhaps catch you more off guard. And I think that's something that's reflected in quite a lot of the work that we ended up looking at through this project, is that it's not necessarily the stuff that advertises itself as horror or as horrific even, but it's the stuff that kind of catches you. And for some reason, there's something about it that's just not quite right, So I'm happy to watch, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but if you show me that scene from The Bodyguard, I am not happy.
And of course, when you were a kid, so I was quite a sheltered kid, probably more of my own direction than of my parents. I sheltered myself. So I wouldn't even sleep with the copy of The Witches in the room when I was a kid. And I'd sort of get out a lot of goosebumps from the library and then to look at the cover and they'd just be like, no, too rich for my blood, put it back. But yeah, I think a lot of the things that scared me, as you say, weren't necessarily from things intended to be horrifying. And I've noted that some of the texts covered in the collection, like say The Demon Headmaster or Wes Craven's Stranger in the House, are intended on some level at least to be frightening, while others like The Singing Ringing Tree that were perhaps not intended to be. So did you face any difficulties as editors in navigating that fact, in these differences in intentionality?
That's a really good question. Sorry, Rob, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say the same thing. I think that is a really, really good question. I think the answer is no, we didn't really. I think partly because we came into it, as Lauren says, with this idea that the things that are unsettling are things that you find unsettling after the event. The book's very much about effect rather than it is about intention, although obviously with some of those examples, like you say with Wes Craven, etc., you can't avoid a horrifying intention, but the horrifying of effect, I think, is far more interesting, and particularly as we move into kind of part two of the book, the memory process and practice, that's where that really comes to light. There's a bit of a transition in the middle of the book, but that's where people start to talk about, using some text which are unsettling or disturbing to cope with trauma or to cope with horror or as a mechanism for discussing other issues. So there's a very, very broad use of the unsettling and horrifying. But yeah, it was really about effect rather than it was intent.
You're nodding, Lauren, so I take it you laugh to agree with that.
Yes, I do, yes. Yeah, I am. Sorry, there was a slight glitch and I thought maybe I'd cut somebody off if I spoke, so I thought it was best just to not. But yeah, I do. I absolutely agree. And I think it's what's really interesting about some of the more reflective pieces in the book is that so much of this memory relies on the context within which you've watched these pieces as well. So the texts on their own, you know, they operate in their own sphere. But when you add to that, you know, the context of being home from school or the context of being, you know, concerned about a Cold War or the context about, you know, being frightened of a dark space, you know, all of that kind of stuff lends itself a very unique perspective. And, you know, that's one of the things that's so interesting about visual media, isn't it, is that we could all sit in the same room at the same time, watch the same thing. We'd all experience it differently, essentially watching a different film, each of us. And so I think the context itself is really important. And one of the really interesting things about the way people have reflected on that in the book is you see how horror is in the eye of the beholder, really. And that kind of troubles some of the more straightforward generic markers we might try and place around these texts as well.
Yeah. I mean, looking at, so I've yet to get to read the book, you know, I'm very excited to do so, but looking through the contents chapter list, I wanted to ask, why was a cow killed on German children's television? Because I looked up the programme and it looked really cute. Like, you know, I expected something that looked, it looked like a kind of German kids programme with these sort of animated cartoon characters, are kind of educational, and I thought, well, that looks lovely.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting chapter.
Yeah.
It was really, really interesting for us to go through and to edit. But yeah, it's a piece of educational television, basically. Something that was shown to children to teach about where food comes from. And it's utterly horrifying. It's utterly terrifying. And perhaps because it's a little peep into reality. And it's the counter to a lot of, you know, it couldn't be further away from lots of children's programs with lots of lovely, fluffy, anthropomorphized animals on them. It's the polar opposite, but it's horrifying because of all that. It just seems so out of place.
Yeah. It's quite ahead of its time, really. It's quite an effective piece of eco-criticism.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I do wonder if some of the most kind of alarming moments as a child are these. So we talked quite recently, I think one of us remembered, I don't know if either you remember these, but these Roald Dahl books on train safety. And I was definitely given them in primary school.
Yeah.
And they were illustrated by Quentin Blake. And so I think there was something about encountering Roald Dahl in a completely non-fantastical kind of form. Because, you know, I'd read lots of Roald Dahl, but then just seeing images of someone sticking their head out of a train and they get decapitated. I remember, it certainly worked on me. I think I was very safe around trains after that. But obviously in terms of scarred for life and sort of previous anthologies and social media accounts on kind of horrifying children's media, often the sort of educational or instructive videos like you know, Apaches, for instance, you know, the film about dangerous farm equipment crops up a lot.
Yeah, I mean, public information films had a huge effect on me, and I know they're one thing that seems to have really ignited a new generation's imagination, because they are so shocking, they are so terrifying. And you know, we often go back to the Spirit of Dark and Lonely Water, and you know, the very obvious horror connections there, but it's some of the others, you're right, like Apaches are really, really really terrifying, and yeah, beautifully catalogued in Scarred for Life. And if we had a conference, Lauren and I organized a conference about a year ago, I think it was, about these topics, and Dave and Steve from Scarred for Life came along and did their show, so we got to see a lot of public information films with Bob hosting. So yeah, I mean, it's fascinating material.
Yeah.
I mean, one of my favorite episodes of Inside Number 9 in recent years, the Ruth Shearsmith and Steve Pemberton BBC show, was the Wise Owl episode, if you've seen that, which is their kind of tribute to public information films, which I think is one of the best things they've done for years.
Absolutely, I'd agree. It was
Really,
terrifying.
really kind of captured that eeriness. Yeah, in terms of individual chapters, obviously I haven't had a chance to read them, but please do tell me a bit more about the chapter entitled An Adult Nightmare, Garbage Pail Kids and the Fear of the Queer Child by Max Hart. Because I didn't get to watch the Garbage Pail Kids as a child. I remember having OCD quite badly as a child. The Garbage Pail Kid card made me feel quite physically sick.
Oh
I
no.
totally remember seeing them and like being appalled by them, like I think almost morally appalled that these things existed. I hated them. Whereas now, as an adult who likes to process these feelings, I am probably going to force myself to watch the film at some point. And I've seen a lot of images that I haven't quite managed to yet, I will admit. But yeah, what's the premise of that chapter? Because it's such a good title.
Max's chapter, for if I remember rightly, is based on their wider PhD research, which looked into the ways in which the garbage pail children were intended to be kind of analogous to a heteronormative fear of the queer child in the 80s and 90s. And so the chapter kind of builds on that premise by thinking about the ways in which the garbage pail kids were intended to perpetuate fear mongering about the queer child and perpetuate those kind of homophobic discourses. But actually, over time, because of their resonance as characters with their intended child audience, they actually became queer coded in a potentially much more disruptive way and in a way that kind of disrupted this discourse around the queer child as a kind of fearful or feared concept, I should say. And so it's a really interesting kind of unpicking of the ways in which that attempted characterization and kind of role for the garbage pail kids was disrupted by their reception. So yeah, fantastic chapter, really theoretically rich chapter. And I think, lots of people will really find something that, find ground there that hasn't previously been covered and hasn't previously been discussed. It's a fantastic chapter, really good.
It sounds great. Yeah, I'm really, really looking forward to reading it. And I mean, there might just be a self-evident reason for this. So I sort of noticed that there aren't, as you said, not necessarily using the term children's horror, although if you ever listen to our podcast, me and Ren are pretty fast and loose with it. I'm a big fan of the Evolution of Horror podcast. I know that Mike Munger, the host of that, often gets accused of being quite fast and loose with his definition of horror, and I think we are much the same. Like, if it horrified us as kids, then we count it, and a lot did for me. So, but I noticed that there aren't many contemporary examples of what we might call children's horror kind of written about in the book, and that may well be that obviously the people writing are adults now, and so are reflecting on things that they experienced or watched as children. But I wonder what, if you have any thoughts on the continuation of the kind of creepy and weird in children's media and where it's gone, like what forms you think it takes now.
That's a very good question. And I think, as one of those childless millennials that everybody's so afraid of in the press of recent, I'm probably not the best person to know. But I do think there's something really interesting in kind of resurrection going on. So, this idea of revisiting older, And I think you've seen this perhaps more with teen TV as opposed to children's TV specifically. But I'm really fascinated by the fact that, for example, for years now, they've been trying to get this point horror TV show off the ground. And they did the kind of Fear Street stuff a little while ago. Disney Plus have just done a kind of Goosebumps reboot that's a little bit more like Riverdale for a slightly more mature audience. So I find it quite interesting that, for me, from my very limited understanding of the kind of children's landscape now, that these texts that were once resolutely aimed at children. I mean, Goosebumps in the 90s was absolutely a kids' TV show. You know, it was
Oh,
for young
definitely.
children. So the fact that they've kind of matured that content for a YA audience, I find really interesting and quite telling. You know, the idea that they've not rebooted it as a children's TV show, they've rebooted it as kind of One Tree Hill, but with possessed dummies. You know, yeah.
Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, I think Ren and I were really impressed by Creeped Out. I don't know if you've seen Creeped Out, but both of us have a lot of time for it, which is almost Black Mirror for kids, basically. Which, you know, is a similar kind of anthology format, I guess, to Goosebumps, standalone episodes. But yeah, Robert, have you any thoughts on the current landscape?
Well, similarly, perhaps I'm perhaps a little outside the age range to appreciate a lot of what's going on at the moment. But I think there's, yeah, I think as you've said, there are still plenty of examples out there which do tap into the creepiness of or kind of creepy quality to certain texts. And I think children have a huge appetite for that, for the mysterious, the strange, the eerie, the otherworldly. In a way that you know, again, you don't necessarily recognize as being strange at the time. You enjoy it for what it is, and it hits you later, which is again another reason perhaps why the texts in the book of the texts that are there kind of have that quality to them. But I think you can see it all over the place. I mean, it's a lot of cinema, things like Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children. You know, this stuff is there for a family audience, and it's deeply unsettling. It's deeply strange and odd. So yeah, I think it's still present, and if anything, it's coming back with more force. You know, arguably reflecting the world we're living in as things become more unsettling. The texts that kind of reflect the world or are parallel to the world that children are living in equally are unsettling. It becomes a coping mechanism.
Oh yeah, I'd certainly say with the kids that I teach that there's a massive interest in horror manga, like particularly say Junji Ito, who if you go into Waterstones now, there's just Junji Ito collections everywhere, and teenagers are lapping him up now. So yeah, I definitely think that appetite for horror and in horror games. Like, to be honest, like watching my stepson play Roblox, like I find a fair amount of Roblox pretty sort of phantasmagoric and horrifying. So yeah, I definitely don't think that taste that children are still ghoulish, definitely. Well, thank you both of you. Do you have any last things you want to say about the collection? I know it's sort of out around now.
Yeah, we're waiting for the kind of final word on when it'll be available. But yeah, we're really looking forward to seeing the kind of final finished copy. I think it's certain to kind of provoke people to think about which bits of their own childhood media consumption have kind of formulated their tastes, perhaps even informed their careers, like it has done for Rob and I. So I really hope that people enjoy kind of reflecting on those formative experiences themselves and where those kind of early horrific media experiences came from, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. It'd be really interesting to see what people make of it in terms of, yeah, as you say, like provoking people's memories and making them think. And I hope, and I think that's one of the things that people will take away from the collection, that it's really varied in terms of the types of writing that are in there. But it's fabulous that pretty much all the writers in there are in some way or another reflecting on their own past, you know, that autoethnographic bit of the books coming through, which is I think was really important to us as an approach and methodology, and it really it's really enhanced the collection.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, both of you. As I've said, I'm really excited to read it. I'm sure I will be lending Ren my copy as well if they don't get one themselves. So that is Horrifying Children, Hauntology, and the Legacy of Children's Television. So definitely look out for that one. Order it to your library, university library, or get your hands on it yourself.
Thank you very much for having us, Adam.
Thanks, both of you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.